Hello, everyone. Welcome to an episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast. Sorry, we're laughing because the SD card just ran out on this episode. And so we're starting over again after 20 minutes of fabulous conversation. But welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm Paul David, your co-host. Pass it over to Will.
It's like literally the best 20 minutes of podcast footage we've recorded. Like you will not believe the things that were said on that. We're going to try and replicate it for you now, but...
We solved climate change.
We solved climate change in 20 minutes.
SD cards, anyway. We're joined today by Dominic Shales, the founder and CEO of Reset Media, who's going to talk to us about AI once again, deja vu, Groundhog Day, AI and industrial decarbonization. Welcome back to the pod, Dominic.
Thank you very much. Feels like I was just here a minute ago.
You did. So by way of introduction, wanted to welcome Dominic and mention that Dominic is the founder and CEO of not one, but two purpose-driven companies, Reset Media, digital publisher, and Dune Communications, a corporate comms agency. Can you break down what those are for us, Dominic?
Yeah, so Reset Media is, we're a digital publisher. So we publish editorial content on the Reset Media website, but we also publish with, other types of publication as well. So we have EVLife.world, which is focused on electric vehicles in the Middle East, particularly UAE and Saudi Arabia, which obviously, crucial transition countries for that kind of technology. And breaking news, just about to start publishing a new platform called Climate Solutions News, which will be kind of for the general public, trying to enthuse people about the opportunities and, coming technologies that can be brought to the climate challenge and, in a digestible way. There are great media out there for B2B audiences and investor audiences, but nothing really that kind of is dedicated solely for the broad consumer and general public. So hopefully in a couple of months that'll be live, and hopefully have a couple of subscribers in the room. So
this is the second time we've had this breaking news on the pod, and the first time was like, holy shit, it's our first ever breaking news exclusive. This is incredible. And it is an incredible, is exactly what I've been looking for as a consumer who cares deeply about climate change. It's very easy to get really doom and gloom because you just, all the news coverage you hear is that we're screwed, and any sort of like solution you read about is some very complex technical white paper about sort of carbon capture in Sweden. To just have like a sort of editorial, hey, this is going to solve the problem, and this is aimed at a consumer audience, I think is brilliant and definitely something the world's missing.
As I said before, bringing sexy back to climate solutions. And also your other role is as fractional CMO at Nexus Climate. If you could break down that role for us as well.
Yeah, so Nexus is a new company. We're an innovation company that's working with startup climate technology businesses. We are launching a venture studio, to get those very early ideas and help to kind of take them from concept through to potential investable business. And further down the line, there'll be a fund that goes against that as well, which we'll raise for probably during the course of next year. And the emphasis is on the Middle East and North Africa, where there's great opportunity, there's infinite ambition and financing and great opportunities which haven't really been taken into their full fruition yet. So that's what we're focusing on.
Very cool. And it's exciting too, in the places where like the impacts of climate change are going to be massive, to like kind of focus there and drive entrepreneurship and investment. That's really cool.
Exactly.
To focus there.
Yeah. You can sell EVs and climate tech to the Middle East. That's going to solve a lot of problems.
Well, just want to frame things for our audience, and we're going to talk a lot about cement, we're going to talk about steel and decarbonization. So just give our audience kind of a general explanation of industrial decarbonization and kind of outline for them the scale of the task and the various decarbonization strategies that you're pursuing.
The other hat that I wear is with a company called Carbon Re, which is an industrial AI company. Let's look at what industrial means first of all. So it's anything that's kind of producing stuff, manufacturing things. So it could be cement and glass and steel, as you've mentioned. It could be cars, it could be fridges, any of these companies that take or use a huge amount of energy to convert substance into kind of end products. It could be oil and gas, it could be mining, all of these kind of things. And these companies and these sectors emit huge amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. So cement, which is the emphasis that we have at Carbon Re, just by way of comparison, is responsible for 8% of all global emissions. And the aviation business, which is often seen as the kind of, you know, a particularly polluting kind of industry, is only about 3%. So
I'm just as shocked as I was the first time.
Yeah, it kind of, you know, the manufacturing process just dwarfs a lot of other sectors. And there's actually one cement plant in China. I'm not exactly sure where, but it's responsible for 1% of all global emissions just on its own.
Because it's like a Chang Sao thing, like that place where the rain's so bad that it strips paint off of it's because of that.
Exactly.
It's responsible for 1% of all of global is cement the biggest contributor?
So cement and steel are roughly equivalent. So they're about 8% each. And it's basically anything that uses a huge amount of energy to create extreme heat as part of the process. So if you've got part of the cement production process uses a lot of heat to take limestone and other things and turn it into the clinker, which then forms the basis of the cement. Steel, obviously, you're melting down, you know, the ore and creating the steel from there. So the way that these things are produced is intrinsically hugely energy demanding, and anything that can be done to reduce that is going to be very good in terms of the emissions and overall energy usage.
I appreciate this quote that they all have. I think it kind of captures the scale of what's going on there. Over the next 40 years, the equivalent of a city the size of Paris is expected to be built every week. Like that, like just, oh my gosh, like people, you know, traveled and visited Paris. Like that really shows you, you know, the impact that like the cement industry, the steel industry is going to continue to have on, and, you know, we need to develop, we need to grow. But like, you know, how do we temper that with decarbonization?
Yeah. And actually, when you look at where that's occurring, it's actually, you know, in the Middle East, in the global South, you know, more generally. If you look at Saudi Arabia, I mean, they've got these incredible plans for, you know, NEOM and the line, which, you know, is going to be a city that's kind of, you know, 70 kilometers long. And, you know, and actually you think it's science fiction stuff, but it's really happening and it's really being, it's going to really be built. You know, and similarly across Africa, there are these new cities that are springing up and new visions of, you know, urbanization that are coming, and all of that needs to be built.
I've heard from a couple of folk I know in the climate sector that kind of like that sector of the world has basically just accepted that the things are going to rise a certain amount in terms of heat, and they're just urban planning how they deal with the fact that they're almost in an unlivable environment. But like that's incredible, like the built environment is the solution to that problem.
I mean, there's huge amounts that can be done through the city planning. It's probably worth saying I'm not a technologist, so I don't know, you know, I don't know exactly how a lot of these things are going to be done. But, you know, the way that the cities are planned is one thing, the way that they're actually physically built is another, and then the materials that go into them is the final bit that kind of, and all of those three things need to work together to be as low carbon as possible.
I saw today that like in the Sudan, like they're predicting 45, you know, C heat, and that they're like keeping kids home from school and encouraging parents to keep kids inside and stuff like that. And to your point, I was thinking about, like, you know, places like Chicago or Toronto are constructed so they have like underground tunnels for when it's so cold, and wondering if we're going to have a similar situation in places where it's just too hot. And, you know, and we're building, you know, to cool places, or underground tunnels to cool, you know, people and work environments, things like that. It's like really fascinating to see how we're going to mitigate, you know, what's coming.
So. It'd be great if we didn't have to mitigate that, right?
Exactly.
I've worked in 40 degree heat in Australia, and it is unfathomably hot. Like it literally, anything that's outside, you're in an oven. Like you're genuinely in the low set. If you put your oven on low heat to keep the warm food warm, it's around 40-50 degrees. Like that's just the outside temperature of everything. It's wild that there are parts of the world that are now regularly seeing that as their temperature, and terrifying. So obviously folk often think of like AI as the virtual world. Like what are some of the ways that it can kind of be impacting some of these very physical, real processes in the physical world?
So yeah, most people think about AI in the context of what's been going on in the last year with the large language models, with, you know, OpenAI and Gemini and all of these kind of things. But actually that's just the tip of what AI can actually do as one particular use case that's obviously very accessible to a large number of people. But the way that AI can work is taking huge numbers of data points from anything and finding models and patterns within that data that can then predict or model different outcomes. So if you look at a cement plant, there are, you know, thousands, literally thousands of variables that can be monitored within the manufacturing process. That data changes from, literally from second to second, whether that's the amount of heat that's being used, the amount of oxygen that's going into the kiln, you know, all of these things. A human can, to some extent, kind of get to know the machine and, you know, be able to adapt things, you know, in the same way as you're driving a car, you might be able to kind of like push the accelerator or the brake or, you know, whatever. But what AI can do is take all of that data, crunch it very fast and come up with predictive scenarios so that the plant can then be optimized to use less energy, to achieve the same kind of product. For example,
is this a digital twin piece?
So yeah, so a digital twin effectively is just a literal copy of the way that the plant itself is operating, and that digital twin can use the AI based software to make predictions about how the outcome might change if the variables are changed. So if you reduce the amount of heat and energy used, you know, how's that going to affect the overall product quality, for example?
Yeah.
As a former power user of SimCity, that is like very, very cool to me.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like you've got kind of a roadmap. So you're starting with cement and then moving into steel and glass.
Yeah. And you know, they're very different in terms of the specifics, but they're very similar in certain respects in that they use high heat, you know, huge amounts of energy. And so the learnings from one sector can be taken to some extent and used in the other sectors. So, but concrete itself is the second most used product in the world after water. Mm. So it seems like a good place to start.
Yeah,
thank God it wasn't Coca-Cola.
Yeah,
to the point we were talking earlier about the website you're launching. This is really cool. Like, you know, you think of AI and you think of all of the terrible uses of it or the stupid uses of it with like really bad AR. It's really cool to know that people are using this new technology that humanity has discovered to try and solve the biggest problem it's facing. And I was unaware of it until we started prepping for this podcast. So yeah.
And I think the other area where AI can be really exciting is in helping to create completely new materials. So yes, we need to keep using glass and steel and cement and, you know, in order to create these new cities. But wouldn't it be cool if there was something else that worked just as well as these existing materials that could be created with, you know, low carbon or zero carbon? And in the same way as like the pharmaceutical companies are using AI to develop new drugs, new compounds that might work in the same way as existing ones, and reducing the time to do that and the cost to do that, that's this new area of sort of material science using AI is going to be hugely, hugely exciting, I think.
Yeah, sort of a question that I had, and it's like just, it's maybe even a silly question, but we talked about like, you know, industrialization and cement and needing cement. So like sort of maybe a layperson would think like, do we need cement? Or like, is there a better alternative? Is there like a clean cement? Or like, could we just walk around on grass? Like, you know, like genuinely, like what is the outlook for that in terms of like alternatives to cement or cleaner and better cements? Like,
I mean, there's all sorts of stuff that can be used, but it's whether it can be used, produced at scale, cost effectively and sustainably. So, you know, you could use wood, but actually then you need to grow a lot of trees and you need to cut down those trees. And actually, is it going to be more sustainable in the long term to do that? You've got to have things which can perform at certain requirements, right? You need to, if you're building a skyscraper, it has to stand up, it has to be strong, it can't fall down,
can't tip over in the wind.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, so fair. So you need materials that have certain characteristics, and that's where, you know, if imagine you could create something that performs the same way but do it completely differently with a, you know, different mix of materials and things. It would be incredible.
Is that part of the, you know, I'm conscious that a lot of the climate change models include things that haven't been existed yet or haven't been invented yet, but are, you know, predicted to be invented and refined and things like that. Are different materials part of that? Like, you know, materials that are less
carbon intensive? There's a lot of emphasis on using AI to come up with these new materials. So for example, in Berkeley in the States, there's a new department of material science, which is looking at this kind of stuff.
Yeah, go Bears. It's my alma mater.
Very good. So, you know, and there's more and more people doing looking into these kind of things, but everyone can predict where we want to get to, but actually how we get there and what form that's going to take is much more difficult. So, but it's definitely going to form part of the future.
Well, good segue. So you're kind of at the cutting edge. You're looking at like cement, you're looking at steel, you're looking at glass, and kind of trying to, you know, pave this path forward, pave this path to use the cement analogy. But wanted to get kind of your sense about, you know, your predictions about global decarbonization efforts and just climate change sort of mitigation in general. Are we just going to completely blow past the Paris Agreement? What does that look like? And what's your sort of outlook for the future here?
So the Paris Agreement set this target of 1.5 degrees centigrade or less above pre-industrial averages. And it doesn't look great. We're not going to hit that unless something really miraculous happens. But I think, you know, the consensus opinion is that we're probably going to hit somewhere between, you know, 2.7, 2.9, something like that, according to IPCC and various other places. So it's not looking good. However, there are the solutions there. And what really, you know, I think all the policy measures should be focused on deploying things that can succeed now in the short term rather than pushing them back, you know, nearer to 2040, 2050, which is when people are talking about, you know, net zero timelines, etc. So if you, there's something called the time value of carbon. So for every bit of carbon that we release into the atmosphere now, in like 20 or 30 years time, that's going to be equivalent to four times the amount being released at that stage. So, you know, because it lingers in the atmosphere. So we need to stop the emissions now to give us a chance to accelerate the decarbonisation further down the track. There are lots and lots of technologies that can be deployed now. So, you know, like AI that can be focused on the efficiency and having, you know, small percentage efficiency gains. The policy environments put too much emphasis, I think, on things like carbon capture and storage, which really are quite untested at scale at the moment. The technologies can work, but just rolling it out is hugely cost prohibitive, you know, and is really not going to solve the issue at any great scale. So I read a stat the other day that said that so far carbon capture and storage has captured about the equivalent of 10 seconds of global emissions. So,
wow.
You know, it's really not there yet.
Yeah.
But there are things that we can do at scale now that need to be incentivized by policy frameworks and, you know, get people on board to start doing those things now.
Curious about how you felt about COP28 and the most recent sort of attempt at...
Yeah, well, you know, COP28 had a lot of flack, and I think quite a lot of it unfairly. I think this transition away from fossil fuels was a big move in terms of getting the wording agreed by all those countries. You know, it hasn't been achieved before. It wasn't the final wording that everybody would have wanted, which was phasing out of fossil fuels, but the transition away from is a pretty good, you know, sense that we need to go in that direction. So I think to that extent it was actually successful. And there were other pledges and initiatives that came out as part of COP as well. They were just pledges, right? And that's the thing. They've got to be implemented to have any meaningful impact. So that's the thing, I think, now that needs to happen. There needs to be follow through, and there needs to be real kind of policy impetus put behind all of those things.
I think that's the sticky bit. Like there's always like these grand pledges that come out of these meetings and stuff like that. And it's like, at what point is the red light on enough that we're like, okay, we've moved past pledges. These are firm commitments that are trackable and measurable and sort of...
I was going to say, a website I've always wished existed for your next one is just a long list of this is what this country has said it's going to do, and here's how much they're actually trying or full of shit. Because I like it, and you know, I think there's no worse example of this in the Conservative government in the UK of like, we're just going to pledge to these things because we know we're going to get our absolute shit ton of bad press if we don't, and then we're going to do very, very little to actually like really try and execute this because it looks really hard and complicated and expensive. And whenever I see those COPs, I always think, cool, yeah, all of this money's been like, but then when you hear from activists on the ground about like actually getting that money, it doesn't sound like it. There's a big gap between the promise and the execution. So yeah. How full of shit are they.com? And just a tracker.
I'm gonna register that.
Yeah. Check if it's available here and go down.
Spitballing ideas I've had in the pub. The other one was like, how evil are they? Where you just put in a brand and it just tells you like, oh, this is why Coca-Cola is super problematic.
Other soft drinks are available.
Moving on to that kind of fight in the fight against climate change. Because I think I've certainly felt this personally, and I'm obviously not actually involved in it. But just as a sort of consumer, is like, it is kind of hard to be optimistic about it from some of the headlines you read, but you have like a real belief in optimism and a sense of individual agency and responsibility. What's kind of your advice for creating campaigns, initiatives, and empowering people to take action and giving them that hope that they actually can make a tangible difference?
So I think there's a couple of things in there. One, I think it's not necessarily just individual action and agency. I think it's actually a collective responsibility. And there are three kind of constituent parts to that all interlink. One is, you know, obviously the individual and society at large, right? We need to step up and we all need to do our bit. And, you know, it does make a difference if we recycle and we, you know, take public transport and all the rest of it, right? But that's not going to be the be all and end all. Businesses have to take a massive lead in it, and then government, you know, by setting regulation and frameworks and policy and things like that. And all of those three overlap, right? And none of them can exist individually. Governments aren't going to take action if they don't think the populations with them are going to respond. Businesses aren't going to do it if the consumers aren't going to buy the product, etc. So, you know, where does it start? Probably starts with the consumer, because they influence the other audiences. You know, there has to be a willingness to engage around policy topics and with products that are, you know, and services which are thinking that way and more beneficial to the environment. I think the other thing is that, coming back to this climate of fear and, you know, desperation around climate, the media generally has been focused on telling the stories of fear. And it's human nature, unfortunately. We respond more to fear,
negativity
and negativity, yep, than we do to positivity. So, you know, if you're a media business, then you're gonna go with that, right? So there was a really interesting study that was done in 2018 by Yale. Do you do your postgrad there? No.
Harvard. Sorry. easy.
And so Yale did a study which looked at the hope gap, right? Mm. And it looked at the
specifically way, around climate change.
Around climate change. Yeah. And it measured over a few years people's feelings of hope and hopefulness versus their feeling of anxiety around the climate. And what it found was that, you know, the media was responsible to a large extent about creating this culture of anxiety that climate was going to destroy our lives and there was nothing we could do about it, etc. And that it was also creating, enlarging this hope gap. So people were feeling less hopeful and more anxious as time went on. It's no coincidence that actually where there was a big uptick in anxiety and a big downturn in hope in 2016 when Donald Trump came in and started, you know, saying negative stuff about all that. So I'd really love Yale to do a follow-up on that. I've not seen anything to see where we are today, but I think that's super important that we try and reduce that hope gap. Mm-hmm. And, you know, reduce anxiety and increase hope, because then I think that will, you know, start to help things moving forward.
I feel like Yale knows a thing or two about hope being the number two university in America. So just want to throw that shots fired, Yale, but also sponsor our podcast.
I don't think this audience will have heard the first sponsor our podcast. So that joke doesn't land.
Fair, I guess.
Yeah. It's funny because there's actually quite an overlap between these two groups. But the people that want you to not believe that voting matters and the people that want you to believe that you cannot contribute to climate change, it's become a real thing of cynicism. And I've had a lot of conversations, even with personal friends, and they usually listen to Joe Rogan, but they're just like, oh, you know, I can't make a difference and it's all bullshit anyway and they're all corrupt. And it's like, no. There are many problems with politics and climate change. If you think Joe Biden and Donald Trump are the same thing, you've been brainwashed. And like, yeah, reclaiming that hope is a really cool idea.
Yeah. I think the problem is that everything's becoming politicized, right?
Yeah.
I
mean,
you know, climate is part of the culture war these days in every single respect. So, you know, I work on this electric vehicle website, and electric vehicles have become massively politicized. If you look at the US, right, it is really shocking to me how they're being used as a weapon, you know, saying EVs are against the you know, the working person, and it's going to destroy Detroit and, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's like, that's not true.
There is a department at Fox that just goes, right, lads, this week, which insane thing have we decided is now liberal and that, like, you can't have if you're a real
books.
Red-blooded American.
Books.
Yeah, but it's books.
Books that
it's democracy.
History.
It's like, just in...
Yeah. I mean, well, one thing to your point, like one thing, and appreciate the approach that you're taking of, you know, optimism and hope. And one thing we like to do on the pod is just highlight examples of, you know, positive sort of lights in different sectors that folks are doing good work. A couple examples we brought up for these from this pod is like HURD, H-U-R-D. It's a new app that allows employees to anonymously rate their company's climate efforts. So that's really exciting. Protect Our Winters, that gets, you know, outdoor people to kind of protect the land that they love by promoting nonpartisan policies designed to protect our world. And the one I was interested to get your perspective on this, the C40 cities and kind of this push to get 96 cities worldwide, you know, that represent 20% of the global economy, all working together to drive climate action through collaboration and knowledge sharing. So I'm curious to hear, like, I'm interested at the city level, if you think there we can sort of, you know, move the needle and kind of, you know, help the cause.
I think, you know, collaboration in any form is great. The thing is, it needs to be more than just a talking shop, right?
Yeah.
But coming back to the previous point, if there are cities which are experiencing 45 degree heat and they can't find ways to mitigate that, and then that's going to be relevant to more and more cities, you know, around the world. What are the ways that they can learn from, you know, the architecture and the design and all these kind of things? So I think when we're tackling a global problem like the climate, it's good to approach it from a global perspective. And, you know, the solutions are definitely not just all born in London and California and Paris. They're, you know,
they're
literally around the world, you know, and we need to take that on board, really.
You're going to upset some people in Berkeley who think all the solutions come out of Berkeley. So careful.
Well, nearly all of them.
Yeah, exactly. Go Bears. wanted to just kind of wrap up. We always like to ask about, you know, your personal journey, and you've had an incredibly mosaic career, business owner, media operator, communicator. You worked in a variety of roles, including Vice Media Group, RIP, Vice Media. So just wanted to hear about your journey from studying modern languages at Oxford to where you are today. And specifically, if you have any advice for folks who kind of are aspiring purpose-led communicators. And I'm particularly selfishly interested. I've always thought of climate tech as the next space that I would move into after this agency. And I know you've kind of worked in that similar space. So yeah, just curious to hear about your journey.
It's taken me a long time to kind of like focus in, on climate as being the kind of green thread of everything I'm doing now. But yeah, so I studied, I've always been fascinated with language and the way that language can make people respond and, you know, the emotions that it elicits. So it was almost natural that I ended up studying languages, which have been completely useless to me in a professional context.
Which languages do you speak?
French and German.
Okay.
And English sometimes. But the thing is, you know, the language of business is English these days, and actually people in Germany and to some extent in France, you know, put us to shame in terms of their use of English, right? So, but as an intellectual thing, that was great to do. I then didn't really have any idea what I wanted to do, and ended up kind of doing work experience in all sorts of different places, and eventually I landed in an agency called KBH, which was bought up many years ago on the day that Classic FM was launching, which ages me, and the prize money for the Wimbledon Tennis Championships was being announced. And, you know, it felt like the center of the universe. It was a very cool place to kind of land. And it's like, okay, right, agency life seems great. These are very cool clients. You know, I'd love to work here. So stayed there for a couple of years and then moved to an agency called Hill & Knowlton, which is part of WPP Group, and kind of worked on big clients, blue chip organizations, some of which have been mentioned in this podcast. And I ended up kind of like being responsible for their business development and marketing across the Europe, Middle East and Africa region, and set up my own agency with naivety, thinking, you know, how hard can this be? So I've been where you guys are, and it was great. So with my colleague John Rivett, who was also at Hill & Knowlton, we set up an agency that took advantage of the great talents of freelance people across all different kind of sectors and specialisms. And we were quite early to the market in doing that. So we got a fair amount of traction, which was great. Eventually sold that agency to Next 15 Group. And I stayed there for a few years and then moved to Vice, which was great. I loved Vice. It was amazing. With my colleagues, Lars Hemming-Jørgensen and Frederik Andersen, we set up a new platform called Change Incorporated, which was all about working with big international companies to change their approach to how they're doing business. And yeah, which was amazing. And you know, and that was how my trajectory with Reset and the various other things I'm doing was born, really, coming out of Vice.
Wow. That's Vice is one of those companies, like, even, you know, people will have opinions about it, but like, I feel like I've shared more of their content than like most media platforms because of, I think, like how real it is, how useful it is, how, you know, I think it's a bit edgy, but it's also relatable in a lot of ways. So just appreciate, you know, what
eye level. That's the,
that's okay. Is that like,
that was the Vice thing is by the audience for the audience.
Eye level. I like that.
The first 5-10 years, it was genuinely revolutionary. It went a little bit off the ball towards the end, but sure. It always happens.
That's when I started.
No one's sequel ever. The first one, it was like, oh shit, no one's ever done media like this. This is very, very cool.
Yeah, I like that concept of eye level, though. That's really, it's like, yeah, humble in a way, and but also like connects to the audience and gives you purpose behind your content there. So, well, great. Well, this has been another fantastic. Sorry I had to do this twice. It's just as nice the second time, y'all. But this has been another fantastic episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Little Humans. We've had the incredible Dominic Shales, the founder and CEO of Reset Media, who's doing incredible work in the space of industrial decarbonization with Carbon Re, and specifically the cement industry, and kind of attacking that industry, which represents 8% of global emissions. So thank you for the work that you're doing on behalf of people on the planet. We really appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you. That sounds very grand.
it is really grand. Where can folks find out more about your work, Carbon Re, and just, yeah, where they find you on the interwebs?
So I think, like everyone, so I'm on LinkedIn, very easy to find there. CarbonRe.com is the website for Carbon Re. NexusClimate.vc, and both of them are on LinkedIn as well. So, you know, please do come follow, connect, all of those things.
And as always, folks, please like, subscribe, give us a strong rating so we can keep bringing on amazing guests like Dominic. And yeah, we really appreciate all your followership and listenership. So we love you. Thank you.